Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
It's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance neath the cover of October skies.
What's up? What's up, everybody? Welcome aboard to the Bubba Show. Todd, Bubba Horowitz, and, you know, our friends over at CTG, they always find some great people for us to talk to, and today they have presented us with an unbelievable special guest, and I'm so excited to have the opportunity to talk to this gentleman. Fresh from the UK, from Camdor Global, Dr. Bob Swarup. How you doing, Dr. Bob?
Hey, Todd. Pleasure to be here.
You know,
it's great out here in London.
It's great having you on, and you know, I know you've got so many things that you guys do, and I think the first thing I'd like you to do is introduce yourself to the audience and tell us about Camdor Global and kind of some of the things that you do.
Sure. So, Todd, I mean, Camdor Global's about 3 years old. I set up back in 2012, and we're, I guess, want of a better word, a strategy consultancy focused on financial services. So we're trying to work with institutions, regulators, with asset managers, really on investment strategy, business strategy, risk management, areas like that. And our clients span a pretty wide range. It ranges from, you know, regulators in the UK through to people like Fidelity, Russell Investments, private equity firms, insurance companies, and so on.
So are you actually doing the investing, or are you advising on what investing to do?
No, we tend to advise. And so what we'll do is, I mean, you know, for example, if you're a regulator, we'll be advising them on drafting new regulation, thinking about how to really manage financial stability risks. If you're an investor, we'll be helping you figure out, you know, how best to do your investment strategy, alternatives, you know, what the macro dynamics are. And if you're an asset manager, we often tend to help a lot on product development and particularly understanding some of the new things that are happening in the world, like regulation, you know, a lot of the stuff that investors now have to be constrained by, and thinking about how to overcome some of those obstacles.
So when you're advising or helping somebody decide, you know, you mentioned a couple of times regulation, and I just give you my point of view. I think, you know, many of the equity markets, especially in the U.S., are way over-regulated. What's your opinion?
Oh, I think, look, I mean, regulation is one of those curses that I think you accept for being in the financial markets. You know, the stat I always like to think of is that if I look at Western Europe in the last 400 years, they've had a financial crisis once a decade on average. They've also had new regulation about once a decade on average the last two centuries. So, you know, that pretty much tells you a lot about where most regulation ends up. You can kind of see where it starts from. It starts from a good place in that, you know, they're trying to prevent excesses, they're trying to prevent bubbles, blah, blah, blah. But very often the danger is that they always end up regulating the instrument and very rarely regulating the people. And that's the problem you have. So you end up with the most ridiculous amount of complex rules, all sorts of hidden costs, which I think are bad for managers, they're bad ultimately for investors. And, you know, as history tells us, usually those methods fail.
And I could not agree with you more there, Bob. And I know you've also written a book, Money Mania. Tell us about the book.
Sure. I mean, the book kind of was a pet project of mine for a long time. Came out last year. So basically, it's a book that looks at the last 25 centuries of financial crises. So starting way back in ancient Greece with the first ever sovereign default and going through to modern Greece, I guess, being the latest upcoming one. And it really tries to understand why this pattern keeps repeating. And of course, the simple answer is it's human nature. But that's kind of like sidestepping the question, because, you know, if it really is that obvious, why haven't we evolved? Why haven't we learned? And so it really tries to delve into human nature. It delves into the nature of markets and credit, looks at, you know, the complexity that we create, and tries to understand why this pattern keeps happening all the time.
Well, it is funny because, you know, I'm a big historian and studied market bubbles throughout history, going back to Tulip Mania, and one that affected the UK and you guys there was the South Sea Bubble from the 1700s. And it's funny because just about 6 or 7 months ago, they finally paid off the final bill from the South Sea Bubble. So I thought that was interesting as to how these go. But when you look at the repeating process, we all know that all markets eventually do the same thing, right? I mean, you know, we hear the common term, and I guess the four most dangerous words in the language are "this time is different," and it's really never different, is it?
No, I completely agree with you. I mean, I think, you know, the one truism actually is that, you know, the world's a very complex place, but really our brain is only ever 3 pounds, and you know that's kind of what defeats us every time. We convince ourselves. I mean, you know, I think Robert Shiller talked about tail risk, tail being spelled not T-A-I-L, but T-A-L-E. And he's right. You know, the reality is we all love good stories. And if we tell them enough times, we start believing them. And that's really what it comes down to on pretty much any market.
You know, it's funny you say that because, you know, I also educate as well as trade myself. I mean, I've been trading since 1981. I was a member of the CBOE and still have a member of the Chicago Board of Trade. And so I've been trading for forever. And even in my own nature, I know that if I start talking about something, you know, I try to make sure that I believe it, and instead of making a profit, I try to become a profit. And of course, you and I both know the disastrous of trying to predict, you know, future movement just based on, you know, things that you're seeing, because that does not necessarily have anything to do with the overall markets themselves, does it?
No, the thing is, I think people just love the idea of trying to predict the future. And I mean, you know, the person I think who kind of got it spot on was the economist J.K. Galbraith, who said that the only point of forecasting was to make astrology look respectable. You know, and I totally believe that. I mean, the reality is that, look, I think it's very hard to look at the markets and say what's going to happen a week out, a month out, a year out. The uncertainty is too much. But what you can do is you can try and understand what all the actors in the market are doing, where they are going. You can start to at least understand all the downsides that are out there. And so, you know, for example, when I do advisory work, what we tend to focus on is perhaps not so much the upside, because that's the easy part. We try and really kind of map out where all the pitfalls are, and then try and construct, you know, strategies or manage our portfolio such that we're hopefully going to navigate through all of this stuff that's coming up. And if it doesn't happen, great. If it does happen, at least we've prepared ourselves and we're in a better place as a result.
And isn't that what the business is really about, is being in the best possible place when something happens instead of trying to predict what happens?
Look, I mean, the business is all about cash flow and longevity, right? And, you know, my take on business is very simple. The longer I hang around, the more money I'll make over time. So, you know, my focus is pretty much on making sure that whatever we create is something that can survive the current climate, can hopefully profit from it, and actually has a future. So, you know, let me give you a simple example. You know, if you look around at the investor universe, you can see their attitudes, their patterns of behavior, things like that begin to shift. You can also see regulation shifts, policymakers shift in their opinions, and so on and so forth. And that forces you then to think very hard as to what are the kind of trades that could do well in that scenario, what might do badly. And because we tend to focus much more ideas on building businesses rather than perhaps thinking about a specific trade in itself, we tend to map all that out and then think about what that means for profit centers. So, for example, recently we advised a U.S. private equity firm on setting up a fund that was lending to small and medium-sized businesses in the U.K. and Europe. And that really was for, you know, a number of reasons. One was it was a very underserved part of the market because the banks had withdrawn lending. So these guys are starved of capital. And that, I think, makes for attractive supply-demand dynamics from a trade point of view. You then have the situation where the governments and policymakers in Europe are obsessed about trying to kickstart lending to the SME sector because they see it as an engine of growth. And politically, I guess it's sensitive because of all the jobs that are in that area. So you know that if you create a strategy or a trade that plays into that, the policymakers will probably support it from a regulatory point of view and will create the right conditions for that to succeed. And then thirdly, what you're doing is you're thinking about investors, and you can see that the investors, you know, the reality is most of the big investors in the world are pension funds, insurance companies, these are guys with liabilities. And the one dynamic that's true for all of them in the last 7-8 years has been that they've been annihilated by the fall in yields. But as much as their asset portfolio may have gone up in value, their liabilities, which are discounted basically as swaps or treasuries, have zoomed up in value by far more.
So hold that, Bob, hold that thought. This is Dr. Bob Sforup from Candor Global being brought to you by the Capital Trading Group, CTG Group, and Nell Sloan. This is The Bubba Show. We'll be right back after the break. What's up, everybody? Bubba here. It's finally here, the long-awaited Bubba Report, bringing you news from all the trading floors across the globe. We've got Scott Cialady, the cow guy, as seen on CNBC, Fox, and Bloomberg. We've got Keith Bliss, CNBC, Fox, and a floor trader at the New York Stock Exchange. We've got The Badger, who writes the hot topics in the political news. We've got myself putting together my own unique indexes that will help you, give you a better idea of what's going on in the market. All you need to do to get a hold of the Bubba Report is go to thebubbashow.org and sign up for the newsletter, or you can email me direct at bubba@thebubbashow.org. We want you to have this report because we've got over 150 years of experience talking about markets, getting ready for the trading, and puts you in the best position to have successful. So email me at bubba@thebubbashow.org to get a copy of your report, or go right to the website, thebubbashow.org. Make sure you get it. It's a must-have for every investor and trader. The Bubba Report. Welcome back to The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz, and we're having a great visit with a new friend of the program being brought to you by the Capital Trading Group, CTG Group, Nell Sloan. This is Dr. Bob Sforup from Candor Global and also the author of Money Mania. Very interested in the psychology of markets as well as helping advise regulators and things like that to make the world a better place for all of us. So, Bob, we were talking about as we went to break about some of the things that are going on, and so you want to go ahead and continue.
Yeah, sure. So as I was saying, if you look at most investors out there, the big pools of capital you have are pension plans and insurance companies. And these guys have been absolutely annihilated by the fall in yields over the last few years. Because much as the assets in this they have may have gone up, the liabilities blew out far, far more. So the one thing that's true about them from an investment point is that they're all desperate for yield and cash flow. Secondly, in a world that's pretty much low growth to zero growth, they'll pay almost any price for growth. So if you then factor that into your strategy as well, and going back to this fund that we helped set up, what that means is you can see a situation where you're creating a trade where the market is giving you, you know, a huge demand for this credit, whereas there's not much supply. You've got regulators and policymakers who are going to be supportive of the strategy and will help you from that point of view. And lastly, you've got investors where you're giving them exactly the kind of product that they need. In other words, you're giving them yield. You're giving them cash flow. And so put that all together, and you've got actually a business that, you know, as a trade is interesting, but actually when you put all that together, it's something that as a business looks like it has some decent legs and potentially can make some money. And then you have a potential to make actually a business that's sustainable, that hopefully has a future going forward.
So as you look around and we see things that are happening right now, and I know that, you know, you've got, you call it an uncertain world, and so, I mean, just to address, what in your opinion and in your views, what's happening in Greece and what will be the net resolve of that, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, Greece, to be honest, I think, you know, maybe I'm the only guy out here who's kind of just gets bored by the whole Greek situation. It's the same, you know, kicking the can down the road week in, week out, right? And if you look at the problem in Europe, the real issue is just that they've got far, far too much debt in the system. The system is saturated with debt. And unless you actually sit down and figure out a way of writing it off, or restructuring it, things won't get better. All that will happen is you'll have the Greek situation playing out very, very slowly and painfully until eventually they come to the same decision, although probably by an unexpected default at that point. And when Greece goes, that's fine. You still got Spain, you still got Portugal, you still got Italy. So the real problem these guys have is that, you know, if they really want to solve the problem, what they want to do is, you know, have an ambitious plan like a Brady Bonds type plan, where you just take all the bad debt, you restructure it, you write it down, you let, as it were, the vultures of the system, i.e. the hedge funds and the private equity guys, come in, pick up all the repriced pieces of debt, restore liquidity to the system, and actually restore the capacity for the other countries in the system, like Spain and Greece and others, to actually start all over again with a slightly cleaner slate.
So if I said to you that Merkel would love to throw Greece out on their ass, okay, And but the reason that they're trying to carry Greece on or keep them as part of the Eurozone is because they're worried that if they set a precedent by letting Greece default, then, you know, Spain and Portugal and Italy, which you mentioned previously, could follow. Is that at all a concern?
Well, that's what they're worried about, right? But this is why I'm saying what you need is an ambitious restructuring across the board. I mean, this is identical to what happened with, you know, the LATAM debt crisis of the 80s, right? You know, if you're a creditor sitting there, you know if you let one go, they all start to go. And eventually, it just ends up a horrible chaotic mess. You're better off killing all your problems at once. And yeah, the problem is that they're already in a situation where they can't backtrack easily. I mean, forget about Merkel obsessing about Spain and Portugal. If you look at the IMF has spent years telling all these little countries in Africa and elsewhere as to why, you know, they must pay back all the money that they've been given. So for them to make an exception for Greece, unless, you know, it becomes a wide swinging restructuring, is hard as well.
So as we move from Greece, one trouble, because I look at the entire global situation and I say, in my opinion, the whole situation of the manipulation by first the Federal Reserve and then the central banks around the world is creating a lot of unintended consequences down the road. What say you?
I would completely agree. I don't think economists understand finance. You know, finance is fundamentally, and if you look at what a financial market actually is, it's not a rational place. It's not an efficient market. What it actually is a collection of hope, greed, fear, and also other emotions. And what, you know, you and I call volatility is nothing more than shorthand for different pools of emotions competing with each other for supremacy. Economists miss that. Central bankers miss that. They don't really understand a lot of these dynamics. So if you take QE, I mean, QE has had so many unintended consequences. I mean, right now, for example, you've got the big three central banks. So that's the Fed, the BOE, the Bank of Japan, and the ECB. They have a combined balance sheet of about $10 trillion, roughly. Give or take half a trillion, I guess. You know, flash forward to, say, the end of 2016, that's probably going to be close to $12 trillion. Flash forward to 2017, that's getting close to $13 trillion. That's a huge amount of money. That's a huge amount of liquidity that's pouring into the system. And what it actually does, from my perspective for the market, is that it completely destroys the pricing mechanism. You just don't know anymore what, within quotes, fundamental value is. So you can't price anything. Now, if you can't price anything, you know, you may as well pay whatever you can, because hopefully the next guy will pay some more. And that's where you end up with all the asset bubbles. At the same time, the perverse thing is, despite all the money they're pumping in, where liquidity actually matters, they're sucking it out. So, for example, all the purchases of government bonds has sucked enormous amounts of collateral out of the system. All the new regulation has actually reduced liquidity in the markets in huge numbers of ways. So you take corporate bonds, and I'm not talking about, you know, junk bonds or ABS. I'm talking about plain vanilla cash bonds, investment-grade stuff, the kind of stuff that insurance companies and pension plans and ordinary investors buy by the bucket load. Corporate bond liquidity has fallen by 70% since 2008. So now, you know, it's extremely hard to move this stuff. The next time a crisis comes along, you know, I'm not sure where the liquidity comes from. You take, for example, now collateral for, let's say, any kind of hedge. You know, that collateral is highly illiquid as well. I mean, for example, you take the ECB for their QE program, they're buying 60 billion euros worth of government bonds a month. Now, they're dividing that up roughly in proportion to GDP. So they're going to be buying about 12 billion of German bunds every month. That is in an environment where the total net issuance of German bunds last year was 15 billion for the whole year. So they're buying 144 billion and the net issuance is 15. You know, you don't exactly have your rocket scientist to look at that and figure out that what they're sucking out of the system is only going to drive the yield on a German bund lower. It's only going to actually enhance all the stuff they're trying to prevent and just creates a vicious circle where actually the easiest thing for them is just to do more stimulus rather than less.
So, you know, I'm from the school that the Fed and the central banks that, you know, they try to operate their systems out of a, you know, from an educational base, basically out of a playbook. But I think you and I both recognize that that really doesn't work in the long haul, that you have to be able to make decisions on the fly. And sometimes you have to make the tough decision. And it seems to me that they don't ever want to make the tough decision. What do you think?
Well, I think the problem they actually have is, well, I mean, I'll be kind to the Fed on one level. I think they're kind of fighting with one hand tied behind their back, because, you know, since they unveiled the whole kind of monetary shock and awe tactic, a lot of policymakers on the political side kind of pretty much have turned around and said to central banks, say, listen, guys, why don't you just throw money at the problem and solve it that way? They won't actually make the tough decisions to look at actually restructuring an economy, to think about the structural side, fiscal side, and things like that. So, you know, that's one big issue. The second problem is that, you know, the Fed and any other central bank, you're right, they have a playbook, and they actually don't know what's going on. You know, when you look at their reactions to events, they're moving forward the way they are, they're really, at the moment, lost for any kind of answer. I mean, you know, if you take the Fed with its unemployment target, it kind of said, you know, we'll think about, you know, cutting back when it gets to 7%, and again 6.5%. Now it's indefinitely, you know, perhaps down to 5%. And it just tells you that the rules keep changing because they don't actually know what to do about a weak economy. And the big
hold that thought, Bob. That's I want to get back to that because that's important. But we have to come up against the break. I'm visiting with Dr. Bob Sworup, author of Money Mania and runner of Candor Global, being brought to you by our friends at the Capital Trading Group, Nell Sloan. You got to reach out to her and check out with her. She's got some great stuff for you, or known as the CTG Group. Make sure you check them out. This is The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz with Dr. Bob Sworup, and we'll be back right after the break. The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. I don't need baggy clothes or
rings in my... Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare. But for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Trust. For nearly four decades, that is the reputation Roberts & Roberts Brokerage has forged with their customers. Now, with their full e-commerce website, rrbi.co, it's easier than ever to buy or sell precious metals via Bitcoin or major credit card. Visit them online at rrbi.co or call 800-874-9760 to speak with an experienced professional today. Roberts & Roberts, when you're serious about precious metals.
Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz, and I'm hanging out today with Dr. Bob Sworup from Camdor Global, also the author of Money Mania. And Bob seems to have a great view of a lot of things we talk here on the Bubba Show, or the psychology of the market. And he's being brought to you by the Capital Trading Group, CTG Group, our friend Nell Sloan. So, Bob, as we were going to break, we were talking about some of the psychology and basically that you were being kind to the Fed. I'm not that kind. I think they're full of crap and they have no idea what they're doing and they have no idea of where they're going next. But you're being more kind. But go ahead and please finish your thought.
Well, I was saying, you know, I think they do have one hand tied behind their backs, but I agree with you. I don't think they know what happens next. You know, I mean, for example, you know, throwing money at the problem clearly hasn't worked, but they're lost for what to do next. And it just comes down, I think, fundamentally to them perhaps not really appreciating, I think, the importance of how financial markets operate. They don't really understand how these things work. They don't really understand the notion of debt. And so, you know, the result is that the answers they come up with are kind of like answers that, you know, a 12-year-old comes out without actually knowing anything about education or stuff like that. I mean, one would almost argue that you'd want them to go and kind of be in the pits and work in the financial markets for a few years. We would give them a huge amount of insight into probably the kind of solutions that might work and might not work.
So, you know, Bob, I do want to also, you know, tell us somebody, you know, if somebody wanted to reach out to you and take advantage of your services and what you do, how would they do that?
Okay, listen, we can be contacted by email. My email address is Swarup, S-W-A-R-U-P, at camdorglobal.com. Go onto Google, Google our name. You'll find our website. You can contact us through that. And, we're always happy to do, reach out to people, talk to them, find out what their problems are, and see if we can help.
And I think that this would be a great call for anybody, because meeting Bob and listening to him talk and reading some of his literature, I think that you'll find that he thinks along the same lines as we do here at the Bubba Show, which is really the psychology and really working out what makes the most amount of sense. But so, Bob, I was reading some of your stuff, and you have in one of the pages, it's all rather complicated. Explain, please.
Sorry, I don't quite understand. What do you mean?
In your documentation, some of your literature, you write it's all rather complicated, and you show the goods and services and the individuals and the firms and the factors and the markets and the government, and it's kind of, you've got a nice little diagram here, and I was just wondering if you could explain what that all means to us.
Well, look, I mean, I think the fact of the matter is that if you look at the world is a very complex place. You have lots of different entities, you've got lots of regulation, you've got millions and millions of investors, individuals, institutions, and so on. And all these people interact with each other, but they don't necessarily understand all the knock-on effects, all the interlinkages that exist. And so when you got the Fed, for example, at one end, as an example, pushing through with QE, they don't really understand the impact QE has on collateral. They don't understand the impact QE might have on the pricing mechanism in the markets, and so on and so forth. And so to me, that tells me the world's a very complicated picture. However, I think the real problem you have is that while the world's a really complicated picture, the problem you have is over the last 2,500 years, in terms of evolution, that's a blink of an eyelid. So our brain hasn't really evolved that much, whereas the world has. So if you want to sum it up, basically the world's a very complex place, but unfortunately our brain has still remained only about 3 pounds. And that's the key problem that defeats us every time. So, what we tend to do as a firm, and what I tend to do in my kind of personal writing, is we just sit there trying to understand the bigger picture, not just in terms of, let's say, market dynamics, but in trying to understand investor psychology, policymakers, geopolitics, just trying to understand all the factors that play into the markets and into the economy from different angles, and trying to make some sense of it just to establish what the big trends are and what that really means for an economy, what that means for a business, what that means for a trade, and ultimately just trying to manage that risk so that you make a business as sustainable as possible.
Well, I mean, and those are great views. And then I was also reading something called the Stanford Marshmallow Experiment. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a great experiment. Which so basically, this is back in Stanford in the 60s. They did an experiment where they got a bunch of 3- and 4-year-olds kids, and they basically took them into these rooms one by one. And when the kid walks in, on the room and on the table in front of him, there's a little plate of a marshmallow or an Oreo cookie or something like that, an ice treat. And the researcher then turns around the kid and says, "Listen, I'm going to pop out the room, but if you can last for 15 minutes, then we'll give you a second one for free." And the researcher then walks out, the kids, of course, being videoed. And what they found was that most kids really couldn't last for more than a minute or two. They pretty much just jumped on the marshmallow or the Oreo cookie and just ate the whole damn thing. Some kind of were a little bit more devious. For example, some kids would lick inside the Oreo cookie and then put it back together. Some kids ate inside the marshmallow and then put that back. And the ones who succeeded, actually lasting 50 minutes, resorted to pretty drastic tactics themselves. Like, they might have just turned around the chair, closed their eyes, refused to look at the table. Some just sat on the treat for the whole time period. And, that experiment at the time, it was held up as showing something that, people call delayed gratification. The idea that if you can hold out and wait for things rather than being short-term, your life will be better, you'll achieve more things, etc. And that kind of led to the birth of the self-help industry. However, that was a complete lie. When they redid the experiment a couple of years ago, they made one very important difference, which was that before the experiment started, they took the kids and put them into two groups and in two waiting rooms. In both waiting rooms, there were a few toys and things for them to play with of pretty poor quality, kind of like tatty crayons, pretty kind of old rusty cars, that kind of stuff. And the researcher would walk in, tell the kids they had to wait, they'd be called one by one, and then he or she would look around and say, "Oh my God, I'm really sorry, these toys look terrible. Let me go and find you something better." They'd walk off, They'd come back a few minutes later, and for one room, they'd come back with all these brand new toys, new felt tips, the whole works. For the second room, they'd come back and just say, look, I'm really sorry, I couldn't find anything better. We'll just have to make do. And then they redid the experiment. And what they found was that the experiment where the kids had been waiting in a room where ultimately the researcher said, I'm sorry, I couldn't find anything for you, in that experiment, nobody really completed the test. They lasted an average 3 minutes out of 15. In the second batch, where they actually have been given brand new toys and stuff, they lasted an average 12 minutes, and a significant number of them completed the experiment. And what that actually told you was that when these people decided to eat the marshmallow or not, what they were actually judging was not so much, you know, some internal ability to hold out and be long-term. It was actually more they were judging how much they could trust the environment that they were in. In one scenario, the researcher promised, never delivered. Why would you therefore rely on him or her to deliver you another marshmallow in 15 minutes? In the second case, they delivered. Therefore, you got a pretty good inkling they'll deliver again. And, you know, I think that's an important experiment. What it tells you is it tells you about the importance of trust to, you know, how we operate in the markets, how we operate in the economy, how we operate just in our personal lives. And, you know, if you look at trust, you know, in the old days, it might have been, you know, at a personal level, trusting a friend, a relative, that kind of stuff. But in the markets, we put a lot of our trust in systems, in experts, and things like that. And so, you know, if you take, for example, the last crisis, credit ratings, and if you're an alien who comes down to Earth, the idea that you can somehow rely on the alphabet to tell you the quality of credit, you know, sounds ridiculous. But, you know, behind that alphabet of triple A's and single A's and all the rest of it stood, at least people believed, a huge system of fundamental credit quality work that would tell you if this paper was genuinely good or not. And when that trust starts to break down, people instinctively will be more short-term. So if you look at the markets right now, one of the things I see in the markets is that because policymakers are playing a very, very dangerous game with their credibility, you know, I mean, they are in a situation where, you know, if you look at what the Swiss bank, for example, Swiss National Bank did a few months ago with the Swiss franc, if you look at the fact that the Fed keeps changing the goalposts, you have a situation where actually economic cycles going forward are becoming shorter and shorter simply because people are becoming more and more short-term in their thinking. You know, you dare not invest for the medium to long term because you're a bit scared, since you just don't know what the world looks like out there, not that far out.
Well, and aren't we? I mean, we are a society of believers. You know, we trust our investment people. We trust the Fed. I don't, but I mean, most people do, and they believe in what's going on. So, doesn't that eventually also create the longer term problem, because we do basically dive in and take that belief system in which you spoke of, and unfortunately the delivery of the banks or the Fed or whoever, typically they never really fail to disappoint, because as you said earlier today, they really don't know what to expect, and they're very lousy prognosticators of what the future holds in markets in general, because again, that's something that we can't really determine based on today. It's based on if you do the right things over and over again, then you have a chance for success and to take away from what's going on. But overall, the central banks are basically just scrambling, and we have this now, you know, currency war going on, which is creating a whole new set of problems or unintended consequences that we could have never expected before. And before I let you answer, because we are coming up against a break, I want everybody listen up. This is Dr. Bob Swarup of Camdor Global. He's got unbelievable knowledge. And this ties into what we do here all the time on The Bubba Show. It's really about the psychology and understand what's going on. Make sure you check him out. He wrote the book Money Mania. Check that out. I'm telling you, this guy knows his stuff. And that's why, of course, our friends at the Capital Trading Group brought him to us, because I'm excited. I'm enjoying this conversation. And I can't wait to get back from the break to get some more answers from my friend, Dr. Bob Swarup, from Camdor Global and the author of Money Mania. This is The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz will be back right after the break with more from Bob. I've been feeling real good.
A man walks down the street, he says, why am I so...
Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz, and I'm with Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, also the author of Money Mania, and he is being brought to you by our friends at the Capital Trading Group, CTG, our friend Nell Sloan. So, Bob, as I was giving you that long-winded question about the immediate gratification and about the manipulation of the central banks, in your eyes, how does this end when it ends? We know it has to end. How does it end?
Well, I think a simple answer is I don't think it ends well. I think if you look around, you're right. You look at the currency war, for example, that's playing out. That's going to have all sorts of unintended consequences. You know, if you take the U.S. already has monetary tightening thanks to strong dollar. You know, look at the S&P 500. The S&P 500 was lifted up till probably the end of 2013 by earnings being better and better. 2014 was mainly about multiple expansion. And 2015 has really been a market kept aloft by share buybacks and dividends. In other words, it's a product now of financial engineering and not so much earnings. You know, you look across the wider world, you take emerging markets, you know, the strengthening dollar is killing them. You know, beyond the fact that their economies are not in great shape, that they kind of played the carry trade a bit too much, the amount of dollar-denominated debt they hold is phenomenal. I mean, there's about $2.6 trillion of emerging market debt out there. And of that, about three-quarters is dollar-denominated. So, you know, that's not a great dynamic. You know, for me, I think where it ends is a huge destruction of credibility. When I look at what's happening in Europe, for example, this constant kicking the can down the road is actually extremely similar, eerily similar to what happened in the 1920s, where in an analogous situation, the European countries had the most enormous amount of war debt left over from World War One. Back then, of course, America was in, the U.S. was in the position of Germany because they wanted all of these war debts paid back. And so Britain and France pretty much then passed the buck onto Germany and insisted that all these countries had to pay back their war debts. And because these countries were in no shape, form, or capacity to pay back any of this debt, what you ended up doing was having this painful set of renegotiations and summits and restructurings for a decade, where eventually everyone lost patience with the whole process. And then they all just unilaterally turned their backs on each other and went off and defaulted. And that ended up in the Great Depression. I mean, to put that in stark contrast, in the 1920s, the Europeans and the U.S. between them won 11 Nobel Peace Prizes trying to sort out that mess and still ended up the Great Depression. You know, Europe so far only has managed to get one Nobel Peace Prize so far, but it tells you where that dynamic usually ends.
Well,
so,
I'm sorry, go ahead. I apologize. Go ahead.
No, go right ahead.
What it tells me is that, again, what I've said all along is that they have no clue, and Nobel Peace Prize or no Nobel Peace Prize, they have no idea, and they don't understand the dynamics of a true working market, and that they've really, what they've done, in my opinion, is they've really, with all of these programs and free money, I mean, the Fed is leveraged at 75-1. They let Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers go broke when they were only leveraged at 38-1, but of course, they didn't have the ability to print more money and make it go away. But at the end, what they've really done is they destroyed the middle class. And when you destroy your middle class, you destroy all of your spending, all of your profits, because the middle class are the people that spend and buy and shop and do all the things that you need to keep a stable, growing economy. What do you think?
No, you're completely right. I think that's where the whole inequality bit really becomes important. You know, not the way it's painted in the press, but the way that really matters to the middle class. I mean, if you think about it, what it actually comes down to, I think this is one of the major problems you have today, is we have this enormous, what I would call the fetish of GDP. You know, I mean, GDP is this sacrosanct little shorthand that every policymaker lives and dies by. If GDP isn't magically going up, your economic situation is going down. It's terrible. You must do something. You must throw money at the problem. But if you think about what GDP actually is, GDP is nothing more than a measure of economic transactions. In the world of GDP as we define it, spending, investment, it's all the same thing. So, for example, if you and I go out tonight and blow a couple of $1,000s on Cristal, you know, that has the same impact on GDP as us taking a couple of $1,000s and investing it in a new factory. Now, you know immediately which one has a better multiplier effect for the economy in the long run. But as far as GDP goes, they're both the same. So you end up in a situation where actually to fuel the economy for the last two, 3 decades especially, the prescription by most policymakers has been encourage consumption. Just encourage consumption. It doesn't matter what you do, how you consume, just consume more and more. Because the more you consume, the more GDP goes up. The problem is, when wages aren't keeping up pace with the levels of growth and consumption, the only way you consume more is by taking on more and more debt. So you end up in a situation where the debt balloons enormously. And when eventually that debt becomes too much, when the system becomes saturated, it has to deleverage. That's the inevitability of it. The one lesson you see from 2,500 years of financial crises is that every system gets leveraged, and then it needs to deleverage, and it has to grow again. And that's where we're reaching. We're reaching that point of no return. And to put into stark numbers, let me put it this way. In 1980, the total size of the debt markets globally, and this is not my number, these numbers going to the Bank of International Settlements, the fixed income market globally was $10 trillion. Okay? You flash forward to 20 years on, say to 2000, and the market had grown to being about $35 to $38 trillion. You flash forward to today, and the market is now $100 trillion globally. That is the growth you have of debt globally. Now, you know, I know, most people in the markets, that of $100 trillion, there's a good chunk that almost certainly will never be paid back, that a bit like the South Sea bubble debt will just be written down over a very, very long period of time. And unless you accept that fact, unless you restructure that debt and reduce it and restore some kind of capacity of the system, you're not going to be able to grow. And this is what escapes policymakers. I mean, they're so obsessed with this fetish of GDP that every decision is made off the back of that. And so they actually end up, ironically, in the same place that we all see in the markets, which is just the same way we see herds in the market. Policymakers are in a herd. They're in a herd where they're blindly going in a single direction, and they will not consider any other possibilities, any other opinions, any other ways. It's ironic. It's a bit like what you and I see in the markets all the time. You see herds of investors form, and they will fall in love with a story. They'll have a single viewpoint, and they can't think of anything else. Also, make it from the same kind of herd mentality now. They're obsessed with this fetish of GDP. Okay. So, Todd, as I was saying, I mean, the problem with policymakers, as much as you and I see in the market, where investors end up in a herd mentality, policymakers are ending up in the same herd mentality. They're obsessed with this fetish of GDP. They're obsessed with growth being measured in a single way. And they think there's only one answer, which is really throwing money at a problem. What they won't do is think outside that herd and look to having other opinions. Okay. And the critical thing is really to have diversity of thought. So, for example, if you look at a central banker, what I would argue is every central bank now should actually contain within it some people who have financial markets expertise. They should have people who are specialists in network analysis. They should have people who come from other schools of economic thought. Because if you don't, you're going to make the same mistake yourself time and time again, like every other herd out there does. And that's a simple lesson that they have to learn. And most importantly, certainly I would argue they need somebody who understands the debt markets. Because that's the one thing that I'm amazed has escaped them so badly this time around.
It is unbelievable. And Bob, tell us again about what you do and about how to get a hold of you, please.
Sure, Todd. I mean, as I mentioned, so Candor Global is a strategic advisory firm, and we work with both policymakers and investors as well as asset managers, really helping them create, I guess, more sustainable businesses. Because ultimately, you know, every manager may be a great trader, but that doesn't make them a good business person. The same goes for any investor. And what we try and do is actually help them create better strategies, better risk management processes, and help them kind of understand the big dynamics in the world so they actually have a more sustainable set of returns and outcomes. And if anyone wants to get hold of me, you can reach us by email. My address is Swarup, S-W-A-R-U-P, at camdorglobal.com. If you Google us, we can find us easily. Our website is www.camdorglobal.com, and happy to always talk to people and learn more about the world.
Well, and of course, we've learned a lot today from our new friend, Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, also the author of Money Mania, and he was brought to you by the Capital Trading Group, Nell Sloan, CTG Group in Chicago. Really a great group. I urge you to check both Bob and Capital Trading Group up. Bob, it was an honor and a pleasure to spend time with you. I think that the way you're breaking down the markets and dynamics are awesome. I really appreciate your time.
God, my pleasure too, and likewise, great honor to be on the show.
This has been Dr. Bob Swarup from Candor Global and author of Money Mania, brought to you by the CTG Group. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Same time, same station. This is The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. Have a great day, and we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks, everybody.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.